recoil in defiance. The nurse is short and squat and stands beside the exam table, her hands folded behind her back. She looks strong and capable, but Anna can't tell from the expression on her face whether or not she is compassionate as well. Her name tag reads Thea Malinowski, and her demeanor reads indifferent. "Please," Anna begs, turning to the nurse, "look at my chart. Tell him I don't need another exam." The nurses at Elizabeth Hospital were efficient and kind, and there is a chance this woman might sympathize with her as well. Anna offers her most hopeful, pleading expression. "Dr. Rilliker took thorough records. Nothing new has happened to me in the last 2 hours. Look at his notes. Tell his doctor what you think."
"I think you should do exactly what Dr. Reischer tells you," she says.
"Duckmäuse," Anna thinks. "Coward."
"It would be best if you cooperated with this exam, Fräulein."
The doctor looks at the chart.
"Unbekannt. Don't you have a name?"
Anna is so tired of that stupid question. Dr. Reischer lifts the stethoscope from where it hangs around his neck.
"I assure you, the exam will go quickly and will be painless if you cooperate."
"I don't need an exam," she says. His lips curl in irritation.
"Very well, if that's how you want to proceed."
She decides then and there that the man is an utter Arschloch.
Asshole.
He has not threatened her with the orderlies, but she knows they linger nearby. They always do in places like this. Anna doesn't fight him, not at first, but she does record the details of this new indignity with clinical precision, listing them in her mind as though writing in a chart of her own. She labels it Dr. Arschloch and Nurse Duckmäuse, the duck for short. There, she has nicknames for them now, easy enough to remember. Dr. Arschloch's hands are freezing. His voice is too high for a man of such advanced age. It rises at the end of each sentence as though he's asking a question. He is immediately curious about the scar at her temple.
"How did you get this?"
He looks to her file for details. Anna says nothing. He rattles off her physical details like she is a specimen in some lab that must be catalogued. He hands her file to the duck to record his findings.
"Weight, 110 pounds. Height, exactly 5'1".
He looks at his tape measure.
"And 1/2 inches. The patient is reticent and refuses to give a name or any details about her age, occupation, and family history. The patient is impossibly stubborn."
He pauses to make sure the duck has gotten all of this information. When she concurs, he looks to Anna and asks,
"Do you hear voices or have hallucinations?"
Anna shakes her head. "Of course not.
You know, I wasn't sure that you could speak when Dr. Winokur called yesterday to warn us about you. Did you know he called?"
he asks.
"How would I possibly know that?" "He told me, off the record, that he does not think you are insane. He believes you are unspeakably frightened, though he does not know of what. Are you frightened, Fräulein Unbekannt?"
"Not of you."
"Who, then?"
Anna says nothing.
"Dr. Winokur also said that when you feel threatened, you use the silent treatment. Do you feel threatened now, Fräulein Unbekannt?"
"I feel angry."
"At what?"
"At being asked stupid questions." Dr. Arschloch looks to her file again.
"It says here that you are not a virgin. How did you lose your virginity?"
Anna hates that she cannot hide the feral note to her voice, or the rage that rolls across her face like a wave.
"That is none of your business." "It is, actually."
Anna says nothing.
"Dr. Winokur believes you are a prostitute, and that the shame you carry over this drove you off that bridge. But I don't agree with him. I see a lot of prostitutes in this facility. They are often here because they've been beaten or abused to the point of insanity. You, however, are too clean and well-spoken and demure for that profession. You have all your teeth? Nice, pretty, straight ones at that. Your skin is unwrinkled, and that leads me to believe that you neither smoke nor drink in excess. Your German is perfect, but you have a Russian accent. There's crispness to your speech that I can't quite identify. Your diction is strong. No, I believe you are something else."
"And what is that?" If the corner of his mouth wasn't twitching in a victorious grin, he would seem disinterested as he answers,
Tilted.
You know nothing about me.
I am an educated man. I make educated guesses.
He pushes his glasses a little farther up his nose.
If I had to guess, I'd say that you are, or at least you were, engaged to be married. Perhaps your fiancé called off the wedding. Perhaps he found another woman. One who is not prone to manic episodes. How close is that to the truth, Fräulein Unbekannt? Should we call your fiancé? Or should we simply continue your physical examination, and you can tell us where these appalling scars came from?
The shaking starts in Anna's hands. She isn't sure whether its source is rage or terror, but it spreads across her body regardless, and in a matter of seconds she has to clench her jaw to stop her teeth from rattling. Dr. Arschloch lifts a thin cotton hospital gown from the shelf at her side and holds it out to her.
You can change into this, he says. You can remove your clothing, or I can have the orderlies remove it for you.
Anna feels the panic clawing up her throat, and she grips the edge of the exam table. Her fingertips begin to throb.
You already know what you will find. It's all written there in Dr. Winnicker's file. I must confirm it for myself. You want to confirm it?
He laughs at this.
You foolish young women always think that I enjoy looking at the ways you've damaged yourselves. Let me assure you, Fräulein Unbekannt, I am not attracted to suicidal mad women who mutilate their own bodies. I will tell you nothing. I will show you nothing. You can go to hell.
Anna spits the words at him and scrambles backward on the table. The edges of her vision begin to darken, and Anna can feel that old, hated memory pressing in on her, demanding her attention, demanding to be replayed for the thousandth time.
Have it your way, he says,
and then he turns to the nurse.
Call the orderlies.
Chapter 28. Anastasia. Losing Cohesion. 1918. Ipatiev House. Ekaterinburg, Russia. July 10th.
Your daughter is a whore,
Yakov says, his hand knotted in Maria's hair, turning her from side to side, making sure we can properly see her shame. Her hair is mussed, blouse unbuttoned, corset loose, and breasts exposed. Semyon stands behind them, grinning, as he holds a pistol to Ivan's head. The boy is stricken with terror as he stares at Maria and the consequences of their tryst. The sight of Maria, sobbing and half-naked, startles my family into silence. But Jimmy bounds to his feet, hackles stiff along his spine, teeth bared, and a rumble building in his chest. I grip his collar carefully. Yet, I whisper, stay. The growl dissolves, but Jimmy remains tense, ready to leap at the intruders. Yakov shoves my sister so hard she lurches into the room and stumbles to her knees.
Cover yourself,
he says. Maria collapses into a heap, too ashamed and terrified to meet our eyes. She fumbles with the buttons of her blouse, unable to push them through the holes. The harder she tries, the more her hands shake. When she can no longer catch a breath between sobs, I go to her. Let me do it, I say, gently pushing her hands away. I make quick work of the buttons, then wrap my arms around her, pulling her close. Not once has Ivan taken his eyes from my sister, and only when she is fully clothed does he relax. Semyon's pistol is still pressed into the pale skin of Ivan's temple, but he lets out a long, shaky breath. That is when I realize Ivan Skorokhodov truly loves my sister.
What is the meaning of this?
Father asks, finally gaining enough composure to rise from the table where he was playing a game of dominoes with Alexei. He steps forward, barely containing his rage.
It's obvious enough, don't you think? I found her in the cellar playing the harlot with this fool. Shall I tell you the exact position they were in? Or would you rather young Ivan give you the details? He experienced them firsthand.
Mother and Olga sit together on the couch, knitting needles limp in their hands, expressions of pure disgust on their faces. They glare, not at Yakov, but at Maria. Tatiana and Olga have grown more and more distant from Maria since we arrived in Ekaterinburg. It is hard for them to accept that she was spared, even though they would never wish such violation on her. I see this in the way they look at her sometimes. Jealousy, and then guilt written in the line of their brows, or how their lips pinch at the sight of her. This is how the human heart beats, a twisted staccato of love and envy, of anger and relief. I doubt that Maria can define this loss of affection with our sisters, but I am certain the estrangement has driven her further into Ivan's arms. Mother, of course, knows nothing of the silent bitterness among her girls. "How could you do this?" she hisses at Maria.
"It was my fault," Ivan says. "Please don't be angry with her."
The words tumble out, distraught and desperate. Father steps closer, his finger shaking in Ivan's face.
"How dare you touch my daughter?"
Yakov laughs at this, and the sound of utter disdain makes my stomach hurt. I hate him for enjoying this.
"She is not innocent." "Of course she is. She's only a girl. She has no idea what she's doing." "You didn't see her in the cellar. Your daughter is not a little girl, nor is she virtuous. How long has this been going on right under your nose?"
Maria stiffens beneath my arm and I shush her, patting her hair, trying to quietly assure her that I will not reveal what I know. While Mother sits cold and pitiless across the room, Father's rage grows hotter by the second. He turns his fury from Ivan to Yakov.
"This is your fault. You should be able to control your soldiers. A good leader would never have allowed this to happen." "Are you going to lecture me about leadership, Citizen Romanov? Your leadership turned your own people against you. It inspired a revolution. They would tear you limb from limb if I handed you over today, and I, for one, would enjoy watching them do it."
He nods at Maria, still wrapped in my arms.
"You deal with your daughter. I will deal with my soldier." "Your soldier deserves to be shot,"
Father spits.
"No."
Maria pulls away from me and reaches toward Ivan, but I grab her arm and yank it back.
"Quiet,"
I hiss in her ear.
"You will only make this worse."
"Look how she tries to protect him. Do you still think she is innocent?"
Yakov grins, victorious, then adds,
"The punishment I have in mind is far more effective than a bullet in his skull."
Yakov makes us watch as Ivan is stripped to the waist and tied to a stone column in the courtyard. His feet are lashed together and his hands tied behind his back. It is an exquisite punishment, designed to torture everyone equally. Chairs are brought from the dining room and placed before the column at Yakov's command. And then, one by one, the soldiers are required to step forward and deliver their worst blow. If they fail to satisfy Yakov, he orders them to hit Ivan again, and again if necessary, until the punch carries sufficient weight, until the damage is visible. I am close enough to Ivan that I can smell the sweat and fear and blood. The soldiers have the worst of it, however. They are Ivan's friends, his brothers-in-arms, men who guarded him in the trenches, reloaded his rifle, shared a tent.
"A lesson,"
Yakov says, after Semyon gleefully takes his turn.
"To teach all of you how dangerous it can be to forget your place. If it happens again, we will use bayonets."
Father's rage is subdued 30 seconds into the ordeal, when Ivan begins to moan. The thud of fist on flesh is nauseating, unbearable. He is just a boy, barely older than Maria, and his only crime is falling in love with a pretty girl. Yet here he is, blood running down his chin, trying not to sob. Maria is not allowed to leave her chair, or Ivan will be shot. If she looks away, Ivan will be shot.
"Stop!"
Maria begs, after another blow splits open his bottom lip. She lifts a trembling arm, her voice raspy.
"Please!"
"Hit him again, harder."
Yakov says to the soldier at the front of the line. There is an audible crunch, and when Ivan spits a tooth onto the ground, Yakov looks at Maria, his head tilted to the side.
Interrupt me again, and your father gets to shoot him in the head. Isn't that what he wants? To defend your honor?
Maria sits by me since Mother and Olga will not speak to her. They are furious and disgusted. Mother is ashamed, but Olga, I fear, is drunk with outrage, appalled that my sister would freely offer something that was so brutally taken from her. But I don't know how to explain this to Maria. She wasn't on the train that night. She couldn't understand. And the secret is not mine to tell. She collapses against my shoulder, gripping my hand so hard her fingernails cut into the tender skin of my palm. I suspect Tomas hoped to spare himself by standing at the back of the line. Perhaps he thought the beating couldn't possibly go on for so long. But he has only made things worse for himself. Tomas watches every blow with rising dread, and by the time he steps into position, Ivan is unrecognizable. His face is something other, inhuman and ghastly. He is a gasping, bloody mess, both eyes swollen shut, lips split open, two teeth knocked out, nose broken. He can no longer lift his head from his chest. Thin rivulets of blood run from his nostrils and splash onto the cobblestones at his feet.
Do it!
Yakov screams at Tomas, spittle flying in a wide arc. Tomas does the only merciful thing he can. Another blow to the head will likely kill Ivan, so he jabs him in the ribs instead, quick and hard. We all hear the sound of cracking bone. Ivan can't see. He isn't expecting a punch to his torso, isn't able to brace for it. So he groans and coughs and spits blood on Tomas's boot.
Good,
Yakov shouts.
Now, all of you, back to your posts.
Tomas trembles, hatred and fear etched across his face, but he obeys the order. I am too afraid to watch him go, afraid my feelings will betray me. Yakov nods towards Ivan's broken and bloody form.
Arrest him.
Semyon unties the bonds around Ivan's wrists so that he falls forward onto the stones, arms twitching, blood pooling beneath his nose. Because Ivan cannot walk, he is dragged across the courtyard, through a heavy wooden door, and into the cellar. A final twist of the knife for Maria. Yakov's idea of poetic justice, given that he found them in that very cellar less than an hour ago. Satisfied with the results of his ghastly demonstration, Yakov kneels before Maria. He squeezes her jaw between his long, bony fingers, forcing her to look at him.
Was your little tryst worth it, Tsarevna? That handsome face is ruined. Your honor is tarnished. You will be forever known as the Romanov who spread her legs for a common soldier. Congratulations.
Maria doesn't respond, but she doesn't look away either. Snot runs down her chin. Those huge, beautiful blue eyes are bloodshot and swollen. Her entire body shudders with defiance, but she does not buckle beneath his triumphant sneer.
Oh, you hate me, do you?
Yakov squeezes her chin tighter until she grinds her teeth in pain.
Good. Now we understand each other. Get your hands off my daughter.
For the first time that afternoon, Father's voice is deadly calm. His lip is curled and his fist is raised. But the blow never lands. It's a token protest, impotent. Yakov laughs and pushes Maria away.
All of you, get out of my sight.
Chapter 29. Anna. The Elizabeth Hospital, 1920. The Elizabeth Hospital, Berlin. February 18th, 1920. Anna's eyes fly open when someone slaps her left cheek, shouting, questions, There's a roar in her ears, so she can't make out the words. She rolls to her side and coughs until her throat burns. Anna can feel her ribs, probably not broken, but certainly bruised from impact, protesting each violent spasm. There is canal water in her mouth and her nose. It tastes like pond scum and old fish. Her entire body bends and clenches, trying to force the last drops of liquid from her lungs. She lies there for a moment, gasping, feeling as though her chest is simultaneously waterlogged and on fire. A man kneels beside her, but she can't make out details of his face in the darkness, only the policeman's cap and the hard, guttural sounds of his voice. "Who are you?" he demands. "What is your name?" The questions are short and harsh, like gunshots, and she flinches as the sharp edge of a gruesome memory presses against her mind. Anna shakes her head, pushing it away, and tries to sit up. The man is in uniform, older and angry. Anna peers at the emblem sewn onto his shirt. A police sergeant. She scoots away from him and looks around her to find a crowd, pointing, gaping, whispering. All of those preoccupied lovers she'd passed on the embankment are now hovering nearby, watching the spectacle. "She needs a doctor," someone shouts. "No," the sergeant says. He sets a large, meaty hand on each of her shoulders and shakes just enough to make her teeth rattle. "She goes to the police station, unless she tells me her name and why she jumped from that bridge." Anna looks at him and sees only a caricature of authority. Cruel and selfish and brutal. It's easy enough to make her decision in the light of his cool indifference. She shakes her head. No, she will not give him answers. "Have it your way," he says. The police station is nearly 2 miles from the canal, a slow drive down narrow, uneven streets. They shackle her in the back of the police wagon without a blanket or any other basic comfort. Her fingers are numb, and her entire body convulses with cold and shock. She's only semi-conscious by the time they reach the station. When the sergeant helps her through the heavy wooden doors and into the holding room, Anna slumps to the bench and pulls her knees against her chest for warmth. She watches the hem of her skirt drip water onto the concrete floor. She struggles to keep her eyes open. "What is this?" Another officer, another question.
"Some rat we dragged from the river." "She jumped?" "That's what they say, and she sure as hell hasn't shown us any gratitude for saving her life."
Anna stares at the floor, counts the drops, watches the small puddle grow larger and spread across the tile. It darkens the grout line. Her eyes grow heavy.
"Suicide is illegal," the second officer says.
If Anna had any desire to speak, and if the muscles in her jaw would unclench long enough for her to do so, she would explain the irony of this. She presses her tongue against the roof of her mouth instead, because she knows anything she might say will come out slurred and incomprehensible, and she doesn't want to be charged with public drunkenness as well. The sergeant kneels in front of her, determined to make eye contact.
"But the thing is, you didn't die, did you?"
She blinks hard, trying to stay present.
"So that means we can prosecute you."
She hadn't taken the possibility of prison into account. But then again, the future was a useless consideration when she went over that rail. Anna simply threw herself toward the darkness, hoping to be consumed.
"You will receive no help until you tell us what happened on that bridge."
A glimmer of defiance returns. Anna lifts her chin, and several seconds pass before she can pry her tongue from the roof of her mouth and control the shaking enough to form words.
"I have not asked for help."
And then she falls from the bench, unconscious. Anna wakes again, this time to the sensation of warm towels and soft hands on her extremities. She can feel her fingers and toes, and her nose and earlobes are no longer cubes of ice. She can smell the canal water in the damp strands of hair that hang across her face. Someone rubs her hands, drawing the blood back to her fingers, and then they move onto her feet. This gentle massaging is repeated on all of her limbs, and she feels the muscles across her body slowly relax. It takes several minutes for her to realize that she is completely naked beneath the towels. Anna sits up with a start, only to feel someone press against her forehead and lightly push her back down. The hand is warm and gently calloused. "Lie still," a woman says. "We aren't done yet." A nurse. So the police brought her to the hospital. This surprises her. Leaving her to die would have made things easier on the city of Berlin, one less indigent to provide for. Yet here she lies, behind a curtain in the open ward of the women's wing. She has little privacy, only this curtain, and she listens to the other patients with growing dismay. Some of them are sick. She hears coughing and vomiting. Some are wounded. Pathetic whimpering comes from a bed nearby. Others are clearly insane, screaming, babbling, chattering. And above this din, Anna can hear police officers shouting in the hallway, demanding answers, demanding to be let in to interrogate her. "Ignore them," the nurse says when she notices Anna's panicked glances toward that end of the ward. "They can't come in here. Dr. Winnicker won't allow it." Anna relaxes back onto the pillows, and the two nurses exchange a glance.
"I am Agatha," one says, "and this is Hedy. What is your name?"
Anna should warm to the kindness. She should be grateful for it. But she suspects that is exactly the point, so she says nothing at all. Agatha continues as if they are having a pleasant, normal conversation, as if they have known each other for years. She is plain and small, her dark hair tucked beneath a white cap. She picks up Anna's damp skirt. "Let's see what they have here." And she begins to list Anna's possessions, while Hedy writes them down on a clipboard. "Black wool skirt, black stockings, linen blouse, soiled and torn at the cuffs, underwear and brassiere, black boots, tall, they lace to the knee." She pauses, allowing Hedy enough time to note all of these details on the chart. "And the shawl. No papers, no identification." Anna watches with morbid interest as they rifle through her clothing, looking for initials, laundry marks, and labels. They find nothing, and in the end, Hedy pronounces the clothing homemade. This is also written on the chart in quick little marks. Hedy should be beautiful. She has all the right features. Large eyes, high cheekbones, full lips. Yet everything about her looks wrong, as though her face has been drawn with a thick pencil by the clumsy hands of a child. Once Anna's personal items have been catalogued, they move on to her body. "We need to remove the towels now," Agatha says. "But you will be fine. No one can see you." She looks at Anna, and there is a genuine plea in her eyes. "Please don't fight us. If you do, we'll have to call the orderlies, and they will be far less gentle." She's giving Anna the option of being protected from male view. It's a small mercy, so Anna nods and rests her arms lightly at her sides, allowing the nurses to remove the towels. As each piece of terry cloth is stripped away, their eyes grow wider, and the worried glances they give each other increase.
"So it's true, then,"
Hedy whispers, aghast. Anna knows what they see, what it looks like, but there is no explanation she can give that will not make the situation worse. Anna turns her face to the cinder block wall. She tries to count the scratches left by other patients, but there are too many, and her eyes blur with tears anyway.
"What have you done to yourself?" Agatha asks.
"Nothing. Anna has done nothing. But they won't believe her. Not after what happened tonight." Hedy holds the clipboard while Agatha takes inventory. She places the pad of one finger at various places along Anna's body. Her left shoulder, beneath her right collarbone, the side of her neck, her temple, one foot, her right calf. They turn her over and look for exit wounds.
"How many?"
Hedy asks.
6.
"Bullets?"
"I think so." Hedy waves her free hand across Anna's naked body, indicating the web of thin silver lines. They cover her torso and abdomen and are sprinkled across the tops of her thighs. Long, thin, puckered scars.
And these?
Agata looks at Anna with horror. When she speaks the words, it's a request for confirmation.
Stab wounds?
There are other marks as well, between her hips, along the soft skin of her lower belly. Faint red stripes, a few inches long. Anna stares at the ceiling, inspecting a tiny crack that weaves and splits above her. She focuses on this fissure, pushing all other thoughts aside. The nurse's questions are resurrecting memories that she wants to leave buried. "Look at me, please," Agata says. Anna does, noting the black rings around Agata's blue irises. They make her eyes look darker than they really are.
"Did you do this to yourself?"
"No," she shakes her head, but she can see the pity in their eyes and knows they don't believe her.
"Can you speak?"
Hedy asks. A nod.
"Then it's time you do so. Help us understand what happened to you. Otherwise, you'll go to jail. Suicide is a moral crime. They prosecuted in Berlin. You know that, right?"
Anna nods. "What is your name?" Silence. Their pity is tinged with frustration now.
"Tell us who you are."
"No." They leap at the single word in triumph.
"Where are you from?"
"Nowhere."
"Do you have family?"
Anna swallows hard, as though there is a stone in her throat.
"No."
Agata is the first to realize they will get nowhere with these questions. "Okay, then," she finally says, throwing her hands up. "I'll get you a gown. Hedy, go fetch Dr. Winneker." The hospital gown is thin, faded cotton, but it covers her entire body and she feels protected again, safe from their condemning glances. Agata brings her a blanket as well, and Anna lies back against her pillow, warm for the first time since she left the bus station yesterday. A few minutes later, Dr. Winneker pulls back the curtain, and she thinks that he looks very much like a physician, old and grey with astute eyes and more patience than personality.
"You've caused quite a stir tonight, young lady."
She doesn't answer.
"She can't speak," Hedy says. "She just doesn't want to."
Dr. Winneker isn't so much kind as curious, and it's clear that Anna isn't wounded or dangerously ill. She's frightened, though, so he doesn't touch her. He removes the clipboard from Hedy's hand and flips through the pages, looking at her notes, and then those written in different handwriting.
"The officers who brought you in tonight want to see you in jail."
Her stubbornness isn't helping, but she can't think of how to answer their questions in a way that won't make matters worse.
"Why?"
Anna asks, in a small effort to cooperate.
"You jumped from the Bendler Bridge."
Anna lies.
"I fell."
Dr. Winneker writes this on the chart.
"The problem," he says, "isn't just your attempted suicide. Prostitution is also illegal."
"I am not a prostitute."
"What are you, then?"
Silence.
"Do you work?"
A long pause, and then she nods.
"So you're a working girl."
He writes this on the chart. Damn him. He's using her words against her.
"That's not what I meant. I told you I'm not a prostitute."
"Where do you work, then? Who can vouch for you?"
She presses her lips together. Again, silence. Whatever patience Dr. Winneker is willing to extend runs out. He sighs and lays the clipboard on the bed.
"Your situation is far worse than you realize. Over a dozen witnesses claim that you threw yourself off that bridge tonight. Your body is covered in alarming scars."
He glances at the chart,
6 of which appear to be from bullets, and 18,
he looks at Agata in disbelief, needing confirmation, 18 seem to be stab wounds.
"Just how many times have you tried to kill yourself?"
"You don't understand."
"Yes, I do. The life of a prostitute is very difficult." "I am not a whore," she screams, and her throat is immediately raw.
She can taste blood at the back of her mouth. All that coughing has left her with a raspy voice and a ragged esophagus.
"I'm afraid my exam suggests differently."
"What exam?" This is the first time she's ever seen Dr. Winneker, and he hasn't set a finger on her. The nurses have the good grace to look ashamed, but Dr. Vinegar matter-of-factly says, "You were unconscious for some time when you first arrived."
"You
performed a medical exam, yes. That is my job. I assessed your condition and learned a number of things." Anna doesn't ask him for details, but he continues anyway. "For starters, you are significantly underweight and malnourished. You appear to be about 20 years old. Your body has endured significant trauma in the recent past, and you currently have some rather alarming bruises on your ribcage and tailbone." He waits for her to refute any of this. When she doesn't, he continues, "The thing that is most damning, however, is the other scar tissue. It's consistent with many of the working girls, I see."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
He leans a little closer, not unkindly, simply pressing his advantage, trying to coax a confession.
"I think you do. It is quite obvious that you have engaged in sexual congress."
Chapter 30. Anastasia. The Warning. 1918. Ipatiev House, Ekaterinburg, Russia. July 17th. 1 a.m. I can hear the cannons booming in my dreams. The White Army coming to rescue us. That is what Cook told me earlier in the day when I helped him knead dough in the kitchen. Our guards were nervous, muttering in the courtyard as Cook went out to smoke a pilfered cigarette. He heard them talking about the Whites and their rebel forces.
"They are coming to rescue us," Cook said, "and Yakov is growing more uneasy the closer they get."
The big guns fired all afternoon and into the evening, the sound ricocheting off the hills surrounding Ekaterinburg. It reminded me of the morning the revolution spread to the grounds of Alexander Palace. The longer the White Army's cannons fired, the more restless our own guards became. They whispered in the hallways and stood in the door, peering at that great wooden fence across the yard as though they could see beyond it. Yakov and Semyon disappeared after dinner. It was a welcome absence, and our meal was almost light-hearted as a result. Later, we went to bed, feeling real hope for the first time in many months. I fell asleep to the sound of those cannons, and it may as well have been church bells ringing out our liberation. Sometime later, a hand slips over my mouth in the dark. I wake instantly, trying to gasp for air, but the fingers press harder, pushing me back into my pillow. I can see nothing in the darkness. I have no idea what time it is, and a sudden, ferocious panic seizes my limbs.
"Shh, please. It's Thomas. You have to be quiet."
Even at a whisper, his voice is pitched high in fear. I still beneath his hand, but he doesn't pull it away.
"You have to come with me."
I shake my head. Ivan's battered face is still fresh in my memory.
"You will die if you don't."
Slowly, carefully, Thomas draws his hand away. I can't see him, so I reach for him instead, finding first his chest and then his shoulder with my hand. I cup his cheek in my palm and can feel the soft bristles of a young beard brush against my skin.
"What are you talking about?"
"Please, I can't explain here. You have to trust me. We have to leave, right now."
"Thomas, you're scaring me."
"Good."
"No, stop. This doesn't make any sense. Why are you here?"
"Shh. You'll wake the others. I'll explain, I promise. Just meet me in that spot beneath the stairs. The one right outside the kitchen. 2 minutes."
"I need to get dressed."
"There's no time for that."
"All right."
I sit up, trying to sweep the cobwebs from my mind. The sound of cannons is clearer now that I am awake.
2 minutes.
Thomas squeezes my hand and slips away without a noise. I don't even hear the door creak on its hinges. I sit on the edge of my bed, counting slowly to 120, and then pad barefoot to the door. It's open. So I slip into the hallway and wait, listening for the usual sounds of Ipatiev House in the night. Restless soldiers upstairs, rusted pipes, footsteps, snoring. But all is eerily quiet. I make my way to that alcove beneath the stairs, fingers lightly brushing the wall. Down the hall, second right, up three steps and around a sharp corner. When I reach the stairs, Thomas grabs me and pulls me against him, heedless of the consequences.
"You're all right," he whispers against my throat. "I thought I was too late."
I try to resist, but he hugs me tighter, his entire body trembling. And that's when I realize he's crying. Tears dampen my neck and pool in the hollow of my throat. I do not know what to do with this boy weeping into my neck, so I let him hold me until the tears subside.
"What's wrong?"
I run my fingers through Thomas's hair.
"Yakov called 11 soldiers into his office while your family was eating dinner. He said you will all be shot tonight."
He may as well have said we were all going to sprout feathers and fly away. I don't understand.
"Don't you get it? 11 victims. You, your family, your servants. One soldier for each captive."
I am still so tired and disoriented. His words make no sense to me. I press the heels of my hands into my eyes, shake my head. Another round of cannon fire sounds in the distant hills.
"Do you hear that?" Thomas asks.
I nod.
"That's the White Army. Yakov thinks they are coming to liberate your family."
"Are they?" Hope, sudden and bright, springs into my voice.
"I don't know, but it doesn't matter. They'll never get here in time. They are still 5 miles away. Yakov is determined to see you and your family dead long before they reach the front gate."
Slowly my mind catches up with his words. "How do you know this?"
"I have learned to pay attention and to listen very carefully."
"You overheard them?"
"It wasn't hard. They were bragging about it afterward."
I wish I could see his expression. I would like to know how he looks at me, but I can only run my fingers over his face. It is my turn to wipe the tears from his cheeks. He kisses the pads of my fingers when I brush them against his lips. Once again, his arms loop around me, but gentle this time, at my waist. My response is swallowed by his kiss. Thomas has to bend down several inches to press his forehead against mine. He rocks it back and forth, agitated.
"You have to come with me. If we can get to the White Army, you'll be safe."
"Right now? I'm not even wearing shoes. My family, I..." The reality of what he's asking is impossible. "I'm in my nightgown."
"There is no time. None. Yakov is only waiting for the truck."
"What truck?" Thomas moves his hands to my shoulders and squeezes urgently. I think he wants to shake me, to rattle my teeth and make me understand. His words come out strangled.
"For the bodies. He intends to remove your bodies before dawn, so no one will know what he's done."
Panic, pure unbridled terror, fear like I had never known takes hold of me then. I want to take his hand and run. Every instinct in my body urges me to flee. I am ready to go right now, this second. I want to go running with him into the night. And then a thought comes so suddenly I am nauseous.
"I can't leave my family. I have to warn them."
A moan deep in my throat.
"My brother, he's still so sick."
Thomas is crying again.
"We can't help them. The two of us can slip away, but 8 people? It's impossible."
This is too much. I drop my face to my hands, shake my head.
"How will we even get out of here? The house is guarded. So are the grounds." "Not tonight. They're preparing for... Yakov has most of the guards busy elsewhere."
Thomas pulls me close and cradles my head against his chest.
"If we go right now, we can get away." "You can't be certain of that." "I am certain. That's where I've been tonight, finding a way out. The yard leads to the woods, and that leads to the river, and that leads to freedom."
"Why are you doing this? You saw what they did to Ivan. They'll do worse to you if we fail."
"Because I love you. Don't you know that already?"
I do.
He has shown it a thousand different ways since we were thrown together. I should respond in kind. I want to. But he is asking me to abandon my family. How can I run for safety and leave everyone else behind? He is asking me to walk away without warning them. How can I doom them to such a fate? How can I choose between Thomas and my family? It is like choosing which side of my body to keep, the right or the left. How am I supposed to leave them, Thomas? How am I supposed to do that? Let me take you. Let this be my fault. I will carry that decision for you, my entire life if I have to. I hate crying, utterly loathe it, and never more so than in the moments I need to cry the most. My eyes burn with tears, and I cannot hold them back. I can't. I think Thomas might throw me over his shoulder and forcibly carry me from the house, if not for a sudden commotion in the courtyard. Shouting, the gate clattering open, the revving of an engine, and then voices by the front door, low but insistent. Thomas's voice drains of all emotion.
The truck is here.
Chapter 31. Anna. The Bendler Bridge. 1920. The Netherlands Palace, Berlin. February 17th, 1920. Frost is on the gate, and Anna wraps her fingers around the iron bars, grateful she can still feel the cold, grateful that her hands aren't yet frozen solid. Her shawl has done little to keep her warm since she left the bus station, and she has long since misplaced her gloves. Perhaps on that ferry crossing the Rhine? She can't remember. Anna has no mental energy to spare for trivial details, such as where she lost her gloves, or how she got the tear in her stocking. "What are you doing?" A man steps from the guardhouse beside her and approaches with the stiff, formal stride of a long-time soldier. His uniform is new, but he looks old and phlegmy. The capillaries are broken in a delicate web along the end of his bulbous nose. Irritated, asthmatic puffs of breath trail behind him, and when he reaches her side, he swats her hands away from the gate. "You can't be here."
"Please," she says, pulling a rumpled newspaper article from her pocket, "I must speak with Princess Irene."
If the guard is curious, he doesn't let on. "Why?"
"I have news of her family."
The guard yanks the newspaper from her hand and scans it. He looks from Anna to the elaborate gate, then down the gravel drive toward the palace. All the windows on the first floor are lit with a soft electric glow, and even from this distance she can see thin curls of smoke drifting from the fireplaces. Anna can count 5 chimney stacks, but she wouldn't be surprised to find that there are more at the back of the palace away from view. Everything about the building speaks of warmth and comfort and opulence, and Anna cannot help but lean closer to inhale the faint smell of burning cedar. Again she reaches out for the gate, and again the guard knocks her hand away, this time wrapping her knuckles in the process. She winces and shoves her hands into the folds of her shawl. He turns his full attention to her, taking in the tattered black skirt and stockings. Her linen blouse is stained and torn at the cuffs, and there is a hole in the toe of her right boot. The borrowed shawl is the nicest of her garments, but even that is working class, heavy and shapeless, knit with coarse wool. Anna is certain he has formed an opinion of her when his scowl turns to a leer. But she is not proud, and this man doesn't scare her. "You have to let me in."
"I have to do no such thing. Now go away before I have you arrested. They don't let whores in the palace."
"I'm not..."
The guard reaches out and grabs the folds of her shawl. He jerks her forward, and she swats at his forearms. He has to bend low to growl in her face.
"You are a fool if you think a little begging will get you through this gate. Princess Irene will feed me to the pigs if I let in trash like you. Now go away while I still have a mind to let you."
He sets his hand flat against her collarbone and shoves hard.
The force sends Anna stumbling backward, and she falls to the gravel driveway. Sharp pieces of stone dig through her skirt and into the skin covering her tailbone. She gasps and cries and then scrambles backward before he can reach out for her again.
Go, he says, the command cruel and final.
And what other choice does she have? Anna sits on the ground for a moment longer, her pride and tailbone smarting, until finally there on the frigid ground, her last, fragile thread of hope disintegrates. She has been running for so long. She has begged and stolen and lied, trespassed, crossed borders in the middle of the night and eaten things she cannot identify. Anna has slept in barns and under bridges, every choice leading her here. To see the woman who lives beyond these walls, the one person she believes who can actually help her. The guard has already turned his back and retreated to the small rectangular guardhouse by the time Anna picks herself up and brushes the frost from her clothing. He watches her from his little perch, hands folded over a small lantern for warmth, eager to see her leave. She considers the gate for a moment. There was a time when she could have climbed it easily, but even then the 20-foot drop to the ground on the other side would have likely given her a broken ankle. There's no point considering it now, so she throws a last, longing glance at the palace, then limps back the way she came. But instead of turning right toward the bus station, she goes left toward the park. Raw pangs of hunger gnaw at her belly, and her fingertips tingle with cold. As she wanders deeper into the trees, she counts her other afflictions. Empty pockets, a bruised backside, a toothache. The sun set over an hour ago, and Berlin is slowly going to sleep. The only signs of life come from ahead, along the Landwehr Canal, where lovers stroll beneath the gaslights, hands entwined, heads bent toward one another. So Anna continues in that direction, because she has no other options, and she watches with a jealous, despairing ache as these couples laugh and nuzzle each other. They all have somewhere to go. They all have someone to go there with. Both sides of the canal are bordered by neatly manicured footpaths. The smell of frost and pine needles is heavy in the air, and she stumbles along, pushing past the couples, startling them out of amorous embraces. It isn't until she reaches the bridge that Anna realizes she's crying, hard, guttural sobs that come from deep inside her. It's the sort of crying that makes her throat hurt and her nose run. Someone calls out behind her, asking if she needs help, but she ignores him. Anna goes to the middle of the bridge and looks at her shaky reflection in the water below. Pale and gaunt and fragile, it seems to mock her. She barely recognizes herself in the glassy black surface. How could it come to this? Anna is small and scared, and she has no stomach for blood. She's seen enough of that to last a lifetime. Too timid for other methods, she pursues the only option she has left. Anna leans over the rail and tumbles head first into the canal below. It is not gentle or elegant. It is a graceless plummet marked by flailing arms and flapping clothes. Anna lands hard on her back, and the splash is spectacular. It feels as though she has fallen onto a slab of granite. The impact forces the air from her lungs in a rasping whoosh. It is only the ferocious cold and shocking pain that brings her back to her senses. Her heavy, sodden shawl pulls her beneath the surface. Her lungs burn and her eyes fix on the light of a single lantern from the path above. Her boots fill with water. She struggles in vain against the weight of her clothing. She resists pulling in a lungful of murky water. What a stupid thing she has done. What an idiotic, foolish, asinine thing. But it doesn't matter now, because Anna is sinking fast.
Chapter 32. Anastasia. The Cellar. 1918. Ipatiev House, Ekaterinburg, Russia. July 17th, 1:30 a.m.
I love you too, I say, kissing Tomas hard. Please take care of Jimmy.
I shove Tomas deeper into the shadows and step from the alcove, just as the hallway lights come on. Yakov Yurovsky stands 10 feet away. The light is bright and harsh, and I throw my hand across my eyes.
What are you doing out of bed?
He demands.
Words. I can't find them. Cannot for the life of me summon a thought after what Tomas has just revealed. I gape at him stupidly, and then, after a moment, point in the general direction of the bathroom. Toilet, I say. But my voice is shaky and high, so I swallow and try again. I needed the toilet.
I am still in my nightgown, barefoot and clearly disoriented. Nothing about me looks like a girl preparing to flee, so he says,
Go back to your room.
What else is there to do? I take one tentative step forward and then another, skirting around him and then rushing back to where my sisters are still sleeping. Jimmy lies sprawled across the foot of my bed right where I left him. A moment later, he presses his cold nose into my thigh, welcoming me back. He is so accustomed to the sound and smell of Tomas that he didn't complain when he entered or when I wandered away after him. I scratch Jimmy's ears, trying to push aside the panicked cacophony in my mind. Think. I have to think. The hallway light remains on. It casts a yellow beam beneath the bedroom door, and I can faintly see the room now. Olga is turned to the wall. Tatiana is curled into the fetal position like a small, frightened child. Maria is sprawled on her back, one arm hanging off the bed, the other draped across her forehead. I want to wake them, to warn them that a monster is coming for us. Jimmy is raised up on his forelegs, watching me intently, sniffing at the air, searching for the source of my fear. The front doors bang open, and there are more footsteps in the hall. A growl begins to build at the back of his throat, and it blooms into a full-throated bark when a heavy fist bangs on our bedroom door. 2 more impatient knocks, and then it swings open. Yakov hovers in the door, a dark silhouette, before he steps in and turns on the overhead light.
Get up and get dressed. There is trouble in the city, and we have to take you to a safer place.
The way he says this is so convincing that I wonder if Tomas is wrong.
Did you hear me?
Yakov asks. I nod weakly. Yes.
Wake your sisters. Do as I said.
What about everyone else?
I'm going to tell them now,
he says, and pulls the door shut behind him. My sisters are roused but not fully awake. I have to shake them and repeat myself numerous times before I can get them into a sitting position. They rub their eyes, yawn, complain about the hour, ask questions I can't answer. Where are we going? What does this mean? Does Father know? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. It becomes my mantra, repeated every few seconds as I tug on their arms and yank the pillows out from under their heads when they attempt to lie down again. The only thing I know for sure is that we need to be prepared. So I throw open the enormous heavy trunk and toss out the frivolous pillows and shawls that hide our jewel-studded undergarments. Put these on, I say, as many as you can. We can't take anything else with us. We help each other dress, tightening corsets, buttoning collars, fastening belts. We all wear simple black skirts and white blouses. Nothing elaborate. Nothing that would differentiate us from any other woman on the street if we are lucky enough to escape. We have to escape. That is the only option, the only acceptable outcome. Tomas is wrong. Tomas is wrong. Tomas has to be wrong. I repeat this to myself over and over as I help button and lace and belt my sisters. I cannot wear my earrings. I cannot risk letting Semyon know I've gotten them back, so I tuck them into the pocket of my blouse, praying desperately that I will see Tomas again. The four of us are huddled together when Yakov returns.
Leave the dog,
he says,
and follow me.
Stay, I say to Jimmy, when he leaps off the bed and tries to follow. I get down on my knees and pull that great black